from Radiotopia. Welcome to The Heart. I'm Caitlin Prest.
That's something you hear every episode of The Heart, a podcast we love here on KCUR's Central Standard. It's about love, lust, and everything in between. Each episode combines sound and voices to make you feel from afar the incredible range of emotion inspired by romantic entanglements of every kind imaginable. It's not for the faint of heart. Well, these days, with everyone and their cousin planning to start a hot new podcast, the mastermind behind The Heart has published a set of guidelines, not just for making a podcast because anyone can do that, but for making a podcast that's good, which is a little bit harder. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to kick off our quarterly audio files show with The Heart's Caitlin Prest. Aspiring podcasters, she has tons of wisdom to share. If you want to ask her a question, call in fast before we switch gears. 816-235-2888. Caitlin Prest, good morning.
Hi.
What inspired you to write Lessons in Getting an Indie Podcast Off the Ground?
Well, to be honest, a woman from the CBC, my home broadcasting system, I'm from Canada, wrote to me and said, hey, we have this special documentary series that we're doing, and I would love it if you wrote a small thing on how to get an indie podcast off the ground.
And so it was an assignment
request, but of course, yes, it was an assignment, but of course I had a lot to say. I had to edit down. I mean, at first I had like 20 different things to say, and then I was like, okay, like scale it back. So I ended on 10 tips, I guess you could call.
Does it surprise you that the CBC wants to publish something like this, or do you see the broadcasting establishment embracing and supporting podcasts pretty universally at this point?
I mean, I think that, you can definitely see that the big broadcast systems, I think that podcasting is a lot more popular in the States than in other countries where the broadcast systems have a stronger funding base.
Is that true in Canada too?
It is, yeah. So the CBC, the BBC, and all of the sort of public broadcasting systems of the countries in Europe, they're all sort of, I mean, I've gone on a bit of a tour speaking in different places, sort of trying to explain what's going on with podcasting in the States to broadcast systems that are like, oh my God, we want to know what's happening. They're sort of still catching up.
Your podcast, The Heart, began as a college radio program called Audio Smut. Do you think a lot of beginning podcasters have the hope of moving in kind of the opposite direction from a podcast to something that could be broadcast in a more traditional format? Or is that no longer the end game?
I love this question because the answer has changed so much over the years. I think that only 2 or 3 years ago, most people working in podcasting would have a hope to end up in a broadcast setting. Even just something as simple as when you're at parties, radio parties, talking to other people, saying that you're on broadcast really sort of is a game changer. You can feel the shift in your credibility. But that just isn't the case anymore. I think that people who are making audio storytelling, creative audio storytelling now, because podcasting has become a viable medium, it's quite exciting that we can be free of all of the constraints of broadcast, the bureaucracy, and also a lot of the rules that have come to codify what is allowed to be presented on radio. I mean, I think that like just even stylistically, like you can sort of hear the American public broadcast sound. You can hear the CBC, you can hear the BBC, and they all have a sort of a similar tone. And podcasting sort of just breaks the doors wide open in terms of like a diversity of style, because there aren't really any rules. The only rule is to find an audience. That's a starting point. but if you have an audience, you can do a lot.
How did you parlay your college radio show in Montreal into a podcast coming out of New York supported by Radiotopia? I mean, can you give us a quick synopsis of what happened in your life between point A, graduation, and point B, living the dream as an indie radio superstar, and then we'll get into your advice.
Sure. That's so funny. I love that. The word superstar and radio in the same sentence is always a fun one.
You can quote that.
But things are changing, you know? Things are changing. So graduation, I'm going to try to do it briefly. Graduation happens. You have your college radio show, and I knew inside my body, heart, and soul that I couldn't let go of this idea, partially because I had sort of been throwing myself into the broadcasting radio scene and going to festivals and going to conferences and sort of talking about this show, Audio Smut, and the feedback I got from people was like, oh my God, like, you don't stop making this show. There's nothing like this out there. Like, public radio needs a show like this. And so I was like, great, that's all I wanted to hear. And so we kept making the show, me and Mitra Kaboli, and I moved to New York for love, actually. It was a total accident. And as soon as I got to New York, I was like, oh my God, this is where they make Radiolab. And I went to WNYC and tried to go upstairs and see, and they were like, you can't go in here. You need an ID and all this. And I'm like, I'm from Canada. I mean, like, you can go anywhere you want in Canada. They don't have these like sort of security guards. I was so surprised. But so I sort of like humbly walked home, and but you know, it was only a matter of weeks before I realized that New York is sort of like, you know, this incredible cultural center where if you like something that's a little bit obscure, like public radio, you know, in Montreal, 10 other people are going to like it with you. But in New York, 1,000 people are going to like it with
you. So can one extrapolate from your own story that piece of advice number one might sadly be to move to New York?
Oh, I don't want to believe it. I don't want to believe it. But I think that, like, I mean, the thing that you could extrapolate is to find other people who love the thing that you love and sort of build a creative community for yourself. Because once I moved to New York, I just, like, there was so much just, like, just talking to people who are inspired about radio in the same way and thinking about it creatively, like, it just really fueled the drive to keep making this show sort of like outside of, you know, the jobs that were paying my rent. And so I convinced Mitra Kaboli to leave Montreal and move to New York and like keep making the show together. And so we just kept making it. We turned it into a podcast just because we were only monthly on the campus community radio station. And we were like, no one's going to find us. You know, no one's going to remember to tune in once a month. So we were going to put it on the internet. And so we were just, you know, we just kept making it on sort of like a broadcast schedule. Like we released it consistently the same way that a broadcast show would come out. And we did that for 2 years. And then the sort of like podcast revolution started happening. Radiotopia launched. I remember when Radiotopia launched and I was just calling every single person that I knew who was remotely connected with it. I was like texting Sam Greenspan being like, what's the deal? What's going on? And I remember him texting me back being like, yes, this is happening. Like Audio Smut is definitely not going to be on it.
Did he say why not?
No, but like, we all know why not.
Why?
Like at the time, well, Audio Smut, I mean, the heart is a little bit, we've sort of evolved in our tastes, but I mean, like Audio Smut, you know, the name itself. I mean, there was a time when people would say to me, look, I really love what you make, but we can't say we just can't even name your podcast on the air. Like we can't say Audio Smut at drive time. Like it's just, we can't. Because the word smut is sort of like, weirdly a bad word or something.
But there is a certain degree of raciness.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't just the name, it was the content too. You know, like there was a lot of, you know, we're known for having like real sex, you know, recordings of real sex in our show, you know, like real sex scenes. Like we say words that I'm not going to say right now because I know we're live on the radio.
Our producer's fanning himself off.
Yeah. Okay. I was like, gotta remember we're on the radio right now. But you know, we use the words that people use to describe sex, and so, you know, I think that to a certain degree, you know, the podcasting universe still is working within the standards that were developed by public radio, and so I think that at first that's why, you know, they're like, might be a little bit too radical, a little bit too too indie, you know, for a network that we really want to be successful. But a year later, I kept knocking on the doors. I kept like, you know, I remember I met Jake Shapiro at PRPD, where I was trying to shop Audio Smut to the program directors of Public Radio, and I pitched him. And then like, you know, 5 months later, I called them again. And I was like, hey guys, I know that you're, I've heard that you're taking on new shows. Like, you've heard, I've talked to you a few times before, and I still think it would be the best idea ever. And then got a call 2 weeks later, and they were like, yeah, sounds great. And
you,
I
finally
think that
got
a big
yes.
reason why they, yeah, I think a big reason why they said yes was, I mean, of course, because we're doing something different and special, but also just, you know, from the business side, because we had been releasing, we had a really tight production schedule.
Yeah.
You know,
can I
like
jump
a lot
in
of
here,
podcasts
Caitlin?
Were sort of like, yeah, absolutely.
You have touched on a number of the pieces of advice you give, and you're touching on one right now that I want to draw some attention to. We'll start with mm-hmm. this bit about creating structure and deadlines in the absence of an overlord, which a lot of people might think the benefit of not having an overlord is not having those things.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, think about like anything creative, you know, like whether you're making a pod, I mean, podcasting is sort of like very time important, you know, like, I mean, releasing regularly is sort of important for generating an audience. Like if people don't know, you know, when the next, I mean, that's to be debated actually. I mean, like sometimes you can release a thing and people love it so much that they'll wait for years for the next thing to come out. But I mean, whether you're going to release every 5 years or every week, things done creatively, like making something is scary, especially if it's something that comes from your heart. Like if it's something that it matters to you, if it's like, you know, your baby, like it's utterly terrifying to put that on the page or to start working on it. And I know that, like, I mean, I see people who really struggle to like get their work out of themselves. And as far as I've found, like the only thing that can force me to face that fear is to sort of create a structure, to create a deadline, to sort of build a team around you that's expecting that you're like, you say that you're going to come out with something in a week or even in a day. I mean, a huge thing that changer for me and a few of my friends, among which like Brendan Baker from Love and Radio, like when I first moved here, we had this little group where we would co-work together in coffee shops with our headphones all day. And just having that structure of like starting the day saying, I want to finish this by the end of the day, and having other people who are going to check in with you about that, be like, hey, you said you were going to do that thing.
And
are you done?
That
do you
does,
want me to read it?
That does get to this idea that you encourage podcasters to build teams rather than going it alone. And again, this might sound so counterintuitive to a lot of people who believe that going rogue is part of the appeal, you know, just you and every zany idea you ever had, nobody there to stop you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have to sort of like add that I'm a really social person. I think maybe some people do really, you know, make their best work when they're hibernating alone for days on end. But just if you think about like, you know, really successful radio shows, I mean, like any really great radio show or any great piece of culture, you know, like even novelists have an editor. I think that having a team, I mean, like just thinking about like one piece of audio, there's so many different jobs that live inside of one really good piece of audio, and trying to do it all yourself. I mean, it's easy to sort of get burnt out. It's easy to stop believing in your ideas. You know, I feel like anytime you make a thing, there's always that moment where you're like, you love it at the beginning, and then you hit that moment where you're like, this is awful. Why did I even start this? Like, you know, and you really start to doubt yourself. And I think that's just a natural part of the creative process. But if you're alone, there's nothing that's going to talk you out of quitting at that moment, you know, especially if you don't have a broadcast deadline, you know, especially if you're sort of incubating something outside of the traditional system. You know, like it's so much easier to just say, oh God, I'm an idiot. I can't believe I thought this was a good idea. I'm just gonna, you know, like make something for someone else. You know, it's a lot easier.
Or make a pie.
Or make a pie, clean my room, you know, like my room is never cleaner than when I'm trying to finish something creative, you know, but it's like, because I have other people relying on me, or even, you know, when you hit a wall, you pass it off to somebody else and they, you know, and they breathe life into it and pass it back to you and you have new ideas, you know?
Caitlin,
there's this book called The Powers of... Oh, sorry.
Oh, no,
I could go on forever. You can really interrupt me anytime.
No. I want to make sure that I get to this next question because we do have other stuff that I want to move on to, and I don't want to leave this conversation without asking you this really serious nuts and bolts question. What about money? I mean, the process isn't entirely free. The time that you spend on it, if you spend enough time to make it good, it can't fail to generate income unless you're just real lucky.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's like, it is a really important question. And I think that, like, you know, I guess I've sort of resigned myself to the belief that to make really surprising, interesting, challenging work, the question of where the money comes from is always going to be a puzzle. And it's always going to be a hard puzzle because, you know, taking risks is not something that people who have tons of money love doing. And even if they do love it, they want to take risks on the thing that they're interested in, their pet project, their baby. And so figuring out, you know, I mean, I think that, like, there's a lot of different funding models. I think that, like, different things work for different people. So, you know, some of them, like, right now, just, you know, getting into the nuts and bolts, like, if you're a podcaster, if you're somebody who's interested in audio, and you want to start a creative project right now, like, one thing that I'm seeing a lot is sort of, like, big companies, but also, like, really great companies, like, you know, museums, magazines, arts institutions, that are really, you know, suddenly really interested in podcasting and sort of want to expand their brand and expand their culture production into the area of audio. I know I have a friend who just got hired by the Smithsonian to make the Smithsonian podcast. And so, you know, that, like, that's a real, like, institutions that have money to throw. I think that it's really important for audio makers to sort of, like, advocate for the value of audio storytelling. I think that a lot of the time, people don't sort of ask for the budget that they deserve because they're, like, you know, excited that they're getting an opportunity. And it's like, no, like, producing audio isn't free.
Right.
You know, and so I think that, like, if we keep asking, I know that, like, you know, there's,
we have to go. I'm so sorry, but
we have to go.
Yes.
That's okay. That's perfect.
Caitlin
it's
Press's
totally cool.
Full list of podcasting lessons is at cbc.ca. Caitlin, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
When we return, our audiophiles bring their winter podcast recommendations. Share yours at 816-235-2888.
We're on a journey with Bernie, and we'd like to let you know that we're in it to win it. To the White House he will go.
Meet 93-year-old Ruth Witherspoon and her daughter-in-law, Anne.
How we help the ones in need.
We're listening to a podcast called Bandwagon, focusing this season on the voices of Bernie Sanders supporters across the country. I'm Gina Kaufman, and not surprisingly, podcasters, like everyone else, are taking an interest in the presidential primaries and putting their own spin on that whole spectacle, I guess I'll call it. Today's Central Standard on KCUR is an audiophile show, and we've invited a few podcast lovers into the studio today to tell us about their favorite podcasts, political and otherwise. Beckett Graham, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Beckett is a local podcaster whose History Chicks podcast is gaining a national audience. And Beckett, your show has gotten some recent love from BuzzFeed.
I know. That was a shock. My Twitter kind of blew up on me, and I'm like, what on earth has happened? And yeah, that's how I found out.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Matt Staub is also here. He's the former host of a podcast called Is There There There, a title I suspect he created just to give talk show hosts a hard time.
Yeah, it's all to haze you.
He's now launching a new business. Hi, Matt.
Good morning.
And last but not least, Kyle J. Smith is a KCUR intern who's also a member of Generation Listen KC and an obsessive podcast listener, like we might have to stage an intervention for him. Kyle, how did this happen to you?
Getting into podcasts, you mean?
Yes. And by getting into, I mean to this extent.
Well, I have to thank my sister for the nice headphones she gave me. That makes it a lot better. And I think a couple years ago when I figured out that you can enjoy stories and do the dishes at the same time and go on runs and do whatever you want, I just didn't stop.
Kyle, it sounds like you've kind of answered this, but I'm curious in a little more depth what you love about podcasts that you don't get from other forms of media out there for your consumption, because there is no shortage of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate that podcast because the only sense you're really using is hearing, that you get to use your own imagination a lot and, you know, paint the picture of what's happening. And it's also a very intimate medium. And I feel like, even though I've never met any of these people in real life, that like I was already friends with Caitlin Prest because I've listened to her so many times.
Well, that's cool. Kyle, Bandwagon, the podcast we just heard a little snippet of with those Bernie Sanders enthusiasts.
How cute was that?
Yeah, they're expressing their love in song. that was one of your recommendations. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Bandwagon is a new podcast. The producer's name is Josh Swartz, and he says the podcast is about being a part of something larger than yourself. And like you mentioned earlier, this first season is following Bernie Sanders supporters. So whether you're feeling the burn or not, I think it's a really fun podcast, and it's cool to see these portraits of people all over the country who are feeling the burn.
Would you say that you're surprised to learn about the sort of stories of Bernie Sanders supporters and the nature of their support, or is it kind of what you might expect?
I think it's a surprise because it's not just focused on like a single demographic. What we heard earlier was a 93-year-old lady who is a fan of Bernie. They've talked to veterans. There's a, I believe, like a 13-year-old boy who spoke at a Bernie rally. So it's all over the place and done very well.
Matt, you brought in sort of a newsy political clip for us to listen to also, although there's one teensy problem with calling it newsy. It focuses on a single moment in the presidential primary in 2004, and news is usually new. So we're going to listen to that clip in a second, but what do you want us to know about Slate's Whistle Stop podcast in general before we do?
So I think it's a fascinating show because it links the current condition with things we've observed in political campaigns of the past, and it says a lot about what the conditions of the country and the state of politics were at that time and draws connections to where it is today. So this clip is about the Howard Dean campaign, but it's gone all the way back to 1840 and all the way to previous, more recent campaigns. So it's a really interesting sort of history through the lens of politics.
Well, let's give a listen to Whistle Stop.
Hello and welcome to Whistle Stop. I'm John Dickerson, the host of Face the Nation. Did Howard Dean's presidential campaign really collapse because he produced a vociferation in which he passed air through his vocal folds with greater force than is commonly used in close distance vocalization? With less than a week to go before real voters cast their ballots in the Iowa precinct caucuses of 2016, we'd like to revisit that death yell knell, that freaky shrieky, that howler that went sour. It's one of the signature moments in one of my favorite quadrennial political events, of all the ones taking place in the many rings of the presidential circus.
That's a pretty interesting thing to explore. That yelp, I would call it a yelp more than a yell, honestly. It took just a moment and it changed so much. Now that the Howard Dean campaign is history and maybe a little less charged than it once was, do they tie it into what's going into, like, what's going on in the primaries right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they draw a lot of, he draws a lot of parallels to the insurgency of that campaign and maybe the insurgency of Bernie as a good example.
So like the outsider candidate.
Yeah, exactly. And just the populist movement and the type of supporters and the demographics and just the energy. And then even the manipulation of how that was spun in the media and the role of the media and how it covers campaigns differently over the years.
How do podcasts handle politics differently from traditional media, would you say?
They have a lot more time to deal in nuance and understand sort of the meta conversation. I think a lot of what Whistle Stop does is it actually takes a look at the role that media has had. So instead of just consuming media at the first level, you're sort of consuming media about media and understanding how it's...
Which is happening right now.
Exactly. Yes. It's very meta.
It's an interesting idea because... Is there ever any addressing of, I think that when we talk about what the media does, is there ever an acknowledgement of the complicitness of consumers of media? I mean, what role do consumers have in being, I don't know, critical?
Yeah, I think one of the things that John explores in the podcast is the way that messages are used to manipulate the public. And implicit in that is you're being manipulated and you need to be conscious of that. And it helps illuminate how manipulation and media bias and certain techniques have been used in the past. So you're a little bit more equipped in the present to be mindful of those and be a smarter consumer of news.
Kyle, since you also brought in a political podcast, what is your sense of how podcasts handle politics differently? Anything else you'd like to point out?
Yeah, I would mention he said you can take more time and have a little bit more nuanced conversation. There's another podcast done by Huffington Post called Candidate Confessional, where they talk with candidates who've lost elections. And Howard Dean was actually on one of their first episodes talking about this and a lot of other things. And it's just really heartening to me to hear these people as normal humans, as opposed to when you see them on the nightly news and they just have to be, you know, whatever their soundbite is that they have to get off so everyone can see it.
I wish that people could see your posture when you talk about when they're on the normal news. This sort of, you straightened your posture and looked very official for a moment. And that's because partly they're candidates who have already lost elections and therefore aren't still running for office.
Yeah, that definitely happens. But also with people who are currently running, too. Like, I think of Hillary Clinton being on another round and they weren't afraid of asking the hard questions. Yeah, that's a podcast produced by BuzzFeed.
Mm-hmm. And we heard that on our last Audio Files episode, which you can always go back and listen to. Well, let's pivot a little from politics to crime, another traditional beat handled perhaps a little bit untraditionally in the podcast realm. Kyle J. Smith, tell us about Criminal.
Oh, Criminal is a great show. So in each episode, they look into a true crime story. I was brave enough on Twitter this morning to tell the entire world that I prefer Criminal over Serial. And I know that's hard, and many people may not want to hear that.
I need to brace you for this. There's something I like more than Serial.
But the host, Phoebe Judge, does a great job, and it's always fun to hear what they're going to dig into next. For instance, on a recent episode, they talked about an old tree in Texas, and someone tried to murder it.
Murder the tree?
Yeah.
I'm aghast. Well, we're going to hear a clip you brought in from this podcast, Criminal. Anything our listeners need to have set up for them before we do? I'll go first just to warn our listeners that if you struggle with descriptions of violence, you might have a hard time with this. I'll admit that I kind of did.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was over 80 years ago, a North Carolina family. It was around Christmas. In fact, a week before we jump into the story, they'd just taken a Christmas portrait. And on this day, the eldest son in the family asks his father, Charlie Lawson, for some shotgun shells. And he was going to go hunting later. And his dad said no. So the eldest son leaves to go to a neighbor's house to get some shells. And when he gets back, this is what he discovers.
By the time Arthur returned home, his entire family was dead, shot, and in many cases also beaten. Charlie Lawson murdered six of his children and his wife, starting with daughters, Carrie and Maybelle.
They were outside. He killed them and put their bodies in the barn, then went into his house, shot his wife Fanny and their little baby, shot Marie, who was the 16-year-old daughter, and killed the two little boys who were also in the house at the time.
And so when you look at this portrait that was taken with these new clothes, I mean, maybe the father snapped, but it seems like it was rather planned out. It has this odd quality. It's like a burial portrait.
It is. It's a very funereal-looking picture, and it makes you think of how they were laid out at the crime scene, which was very strange. He carefully took each body and placed it in a funerary posture. He put the baby in her crib. But each of the other victims he laid out with their hands crossed over their chest like a body in a coffin and put rocks under their heads for pillows. So when people came to the crime scene, the bodies were very carefully arranged.
So he had gone back after he'd killed everyone and kind of set them all up.
Yes, set them all up. I mean, strange to say, but it sounds like very lovingly, which, you know, of course, shows how deranged he was at the time that he would murder them and then do such a caring act as setting out the bodies the way he did.
And what happens to him?
He went into the woods after he finished killing his family and shot himself.
And that noise is extra disturbing there, even though there's nothing inherently disturbing about that noise. Kyle, what do you think this clip illustrates about the podcast Criminal?
It's definitely quality storytelling. And again, another characteristic of podcasts is they're able to take a little bit more time with it and dig deeper than you may get if it were just like a quick Dateline story.
KCUR's Central Standard has to take a short break. We'll get right back to our audio files and their podcast recommendations when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Welcome back. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman here with the audio files. There are podcast critics Beckett Graham, Matt Staub, and Kyle J. Smith. Let's dive right back into their recommendations. Beckett, I want to talk to you about myths and legends, because we've been talking a lot about how podcasts approach the stuff of daily news differently than daily news. However, there are also podcasts that just thematically go a totally different direction.
Well, Myths and Legends, the host actually reads to you a folklore story or a myth from history and relates it to the modern day. For example, The Hunger Games, loosely based on the story of Theseus. And Vikings, a very popular show that's on now, is actually based on a possibly real or maybe not real hero, similar to King Arthur in England, called Ragnar Lodbrok. So you never know. It adds dimension, this podcast, to your favorite stories, and it provides a lot of cultural literacy, because a lot of things, art and shows that are produced today owe a lot to myths and legends.
There is a tone. There's like a kind of voice to this storytelling that is not, even though the stories themselves are sort of like once upon a time in a land far away, the tone is very fresh and new.
It is. He's a little bit sardonic, and then there's places where he doesn't believe what's happening and has an aside where he's just like, seriously, this is what happened. I think he got in a little bit of trouble with Little Mermaid. He wasn't taking that very seriously at all.
And it's important to do that.
Well, is it? I mean, I don't know.
It's someday I'm going to be part of your world, Beckett. Okay, but I want to know from you, before we listen to this clip, what do our listeners need to know about the story they're about to hear a little snippet of?
Well, Frozen, anyone who has small children has probably heard Frozen.
Oh, God, or anyone who hasn't has heard that song.
Yeah. Is loosely, very loosely based on an old story called The Snow Queen. Now, also, there's a movie called The Snow Queen coming out starring Charlize Theron. So it's got multifaceted cultural impact here, this story that he's reading to you.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of myths and legends.
Gerda rides the reindeer across the forests, tundra, frozen lakes, and all that. And she runs out of food. She comes to the hut of one woman, who tells her to go see another Finnish fortune teller, and after 100 more freezing miles on the back of a reindeer, Gerda comes to that woman. The woman is small and dirty, and for some reason barely clothed, but nice. She confirms that Kay is with the Snow Queen, and quietly to the reindeer tells him everything. The Finnish woman goes infrequently to the Snow Queen's fortress, and she's seen Kay. The thing is, he's completely happy there. And she informs the reindeer that Kay has the demon glass lodged in his heart. The reindeer doesn't ask the question, what is demon glass, but instead asks if she, with her magic, can give Gerda the strength of 12 men. The witch said that Gerda already has all she needs. She's made it through several dangers to northern Finland in the winter. Her greatest power comes from her innocence and purity of heart. No power the Finnish woman can give her can top that. I personally would say, so is that a no on the strength of 12 men? Or maybe I can have that in addition? Never mind.
Beckett, so in general, I mean, are we hearing something really representative of how this show always sounds, this podcast?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. He'll tell you the story, and then there's parts that diverge from what any human being might consider rational, and he'll let you know how he feels about that.
Well, and one thing we haven't talked about is that there is a really compelling use of music here.
I think that is key to a lot of the podcasts I listen to. We talked earlier about how the only sense you really have when you're listening to a podcast is hearing, and it adds a dimension to hearing, and sometimes it kind of causes a little adrenaline burst. If you're listening to the right music at the right time, it affects your emotions too. So I think the best podcasts use music very effectively.
Well, let's turn to another one of your recommendations, Beckett Graham. You've brought in a podcast called You Must Remember This. What's the overall idea?
The overall idea of You Must Remember This is classic Hollywood background stories. Hollywood, I think, was the original Instagram. It only showed the good parts. So what you might know about someone is that they're an icon, but you wouldn't know the struggle they got through to get there. You might know about the stardom, but not, say, the humanitarian side of the star that you are.
So it's also maybe the grocery store aisle publication?
I don't know. It goes in pretty deep. It takes you through, for example, I think the clip I brought, the star that we were talking about, Audrey Hepburn, started out very, very poor because of the war. She went through some trauma that affected her whole life and then turned out to be such a humanitarian icon. But hardly anyone ever talks about that.
Yeah, people talk a lot more about other things about her. Let's give a listen to You Must Remember This.
After the war, Audrey moved to London to try to resume her ballet studies. But she soon had to face facts. Too much time had passed during the war, and she was now too old and too tall to dance at a high level. She got a few chorus line jobs, modeled a bit, and appeared in a few British movies. While shooting one of those movies in Monte Carlo, she was spotted by the writer Colette, whose novella Gigi was being adapted for Broadway by screenwriter Anita Loos. At virtually the same time, Audrey was asked to do a screen test for the American director William Wyler, who was looking for a girl without an American accent who he could cast as a European princess in a frothy romance called Roman Holiday. The essentially unknown Hepburn landed both parts. She was soon on an ocean liner to New York. The first place she was taken off the boat was to Richard Avedon's studio, where she was photographed for Harper's Bazaar. The next stop was a World Series game at Yankee Stadium. Audrey had never seen a baseball game before and had no idea what was going on, but ever the good sport, she played along.
So, Beckett, what do you want us to know about this?
I just think I like the way that the host relates the stories of Hollywood stars of the past as friends. So she's telling you as if, oh, you know, me and Audrey, we're just hanging out, we're just friends. And I just love that. It's so casual, and I think it makes the stories go in. If you feel like you really know the person and some of the background, we, of course, heard her rise to stardom, but there's also talk about her basic starvation at home during World War II, and there was nothing to eat but tulip bulbs. That's not really very appetizing.
Yeah, and it's not glamorous.
No.
So this is from the podcast You Must Remember This. We've just been hearing that. Let's talk quickly about Lexicon Valley. Beckett and I believe Matt, you guys both recommended this one independently of one another. We don't have a clip to play this morning, but tell us about it before we go. Matt?
Yeah, it takes a really in-depth look at, they may take one word and they may spend 45 minutes tracing the etymology of the word, how it's evolved and its usage over time. And it really explores the evolving nature of language and how we use it and how meaning changes over time and how nonsensical things like strange idioms came about. And it's really fascinating if you're interested in language.
What do you think about it? What else do you want to share with us, Beckett?
There are other things they talk about, like their pet peeves in language are also how hard it is to translate a show like Seinfeld, for example. So they have a whole episode about, like, why is that so impossible? They go in depth, and we can't really have a clip because they curse in Yiddish, English, and several romance languages. But one of my favorite shows is they try to figure out where the word cockamamie came from. And I'm very much a fan of that word. So that was very interesting.
Without using any of the words we can't use, are you able to tell us the answer to that?
I'm not Exactly, because they follow several bunny trails. However, they do mention roosters and Mamie Eisenhower.
Whoa. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing because they don't always answer the question. Yeah. They say there's several theories and this is the best we can do. And that's, I guess, sort of strangely gratifying.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, I want to hear about Where There's Smoke. Kyle, you brought in that clip. Tell us about Where There's Smoke.
Yeah, so their byline is a weekly podcast that explores self-development through the filter of current events, sports, and pop culture. So self-development sounds cool, but you could also say self-help or self-care. But what I really like about this show is the two gentlemen who do it, Brett Gaida and Nick Jaworski, do more than just like sit around and drink beers and talk about being better humans. They have a very highly produced show.
But do they do that?
It's a lot of fun and it moves quickly. I don't think I've listened to the beer episode yet. No, I'm sure they do in real life. but it's fantastic.
Okay, let's give a listen to a clip from Where There's Smoke.
Have we ever lied to the audience?
This week on Where There's Smoke.
All creatures, big or small, have deception as part of their armamentry.
Where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down.
Sometimes you also have to lie in a way because you're making somebody happy, like if you're throwing a surprise.
The myth of epiphany is not that you don't have flashes of insight. Of course, we all do. The myth is that that's the hard part.
That makes sense.
How's it going?
Hey, man, it's going good. Am I supposed to be like on right now?
Oh yeah, this is happening. I want this to be from Brett Gaida and listeners like you. It's Where There's Smoke, an exploration of the self told week by week. I'm Nick Jaworski. For the past few weeks, I've been trying to figure out lying, or if you want to get technical about it, and apparently I do, I've been trying to figure out why we lie, when, to who, questions like that. And on the other hand, I've been trying to understand the value of truth. When is it good for us, and when can it hold us back? And to be honest, it hasn't always been easy, and it's required me to ask some pretty personal questions of myself and the people around me.
So this sounds both fun and deep, Kyle. Mm-hmm. It also sounds like something else I've heard, and I think it's This American Life.
That was Serial they were doing.
Right.
Yeah, so
okay.
those two episodes are an ode to Serial.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't always sound like Serial.
It does not always sound like Serial, no.
What does it usually sound like?
So they usually interview one expert and then cut with them talking and then sound bites from popular movies or songs or stuff like that.
What in this exploration of telling the truth and the importance of it, it's an interesting thing to explore when you're in this storytelling medium because mm-hmm. there's a certain level of relevance, I mean, in terms of what all of us do, whether we're fictional storytellers or people in public radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And they get really in depth and they, you know, like they mentioned, are looking into the word lies. And I think what holds it up is lie just has such a negative connotation when really, you know, it's just normal interactions with people.
Kyle J. Smith, KCUR intern, podcast addict. Thanks for everything.
Thank you, Gina.
And Matt Staub, good luck in your new company, Proxima.
Thank you.
Beckett Graham, co-host of the History Chicks podcast, thanks for being an audiophile.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go, there's a good chance you've been hearing about the Folk Alliance International Conference that happened here in Kansas City over the weekend. Every year, it seems that people hang out in the hotel late into the night, jamming and having an awesome time that I hear about later. So we sent our reporter, Hannah Copeland, to check out that hotel scene at the Westin. Here's her audio diary of the experience.
All right, before I can get upstairs to these showcases, I have to make it through the lobby, which kind of is like a giant circus. It's like everyone here is a performer and a fan. There's people jamming everywhere, like over in this corner. We have a tiny guitar. I don't even know what that is. Maybe a ukulele, a mandolin, two guitars, banjo, all kinds of stuff.
My name is Anisha Love. Well, right now I'm just walking around and making sure the lobby stays looking clean and having a good time socializing with the guests and enjoying it.
So you said you worked here for 7 months, yes. But you've never worked at the Folk Alliance before. What's it like?
I'm loving this. And it's all just different music. Everybody's cool and laid back and just vibing and doing their own thing. I love it. It's just amazing.
Pretty much everyone in that jam session is wearing a flannel shirt. We got a lot of handlebar mustaches here. And many fedoras. A plethora of fedoras here at Folk Alliance. Everyone's carrying black cases with silver zippers and latches. Perhaps you can hear that jam session drift away, the sound as I come up the escalator next to the Westin Hotel waterfall on my way to the inevitably overcrowded elevators. I'm walking by this waterfall right now, and we have a tuba player. Wow. Hey.
Hi.
Tell me your name again.
Christian.
Christian, what's your last name?
Leclerc.
All right. Where are you from?
Montreal.
Have you been to Folk Alliance before?
No, it's the first time.
What do you think?
Oh, it's overwhelming. It's incredible. I've never seen so many musicians at the same place at the same time.
Okay, well, I'll let you get back to practice.
Okay, thank
Good
you.
Good to meet you, Christian.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Bye.
I hopped off the elevator at floor 5. I'm just going to walk up to 7. That was too crowded. Through this fire escape, it's all exposed concrete and kind of rusty stairs, honestly, and just every corner of it is covered in posters. We got everything's hanging up with blue painter's tape. There's probably 75 posters in the 20 square foot area that I'm walking in. So I'm in room 739 with Calvin Arsenia. Hey, Calvin.
Hi.
And what are you about to do?
I'm gonna do some warm-ups.
For?
Getting ready to play a private showcase up here, and my voice is pretty tired since the conference has been so exciting and driving. I was up really late last night, up early this morning, and I'm laying on my back, and I'm going to sing some pretty embarrassing warm-ups.
All right, the Layout Concert by Calvin Arsenia. Here we go.
And so on.
Back out into the crowded and increasingly kind of stanky hallway.
Oh my God. We did it again.
It's 6. We're at 6, girls.
And there's a band that's fretting right in front of me because they've accidentally carried their cello to the wrong floor 3 times.
Excuse me.
Can I ask you some questions about the party?
Sure. Can we do it in the bathroom?
Yeah, it's fine. Alrighty, so I'm in the bathroom of room number 65 with the organizer of the room. Overalls are hanging off the shower. We have a beer in a bathtub, some tea.
There's water here and cheap beer here, more expensive beer.
There's a guitar in the shower, actually.
I'm Mark Smeltzer, and I'm one of the organizers. My wife is the actual organizer. I'm sort of the disorganized part of this show.
What does it take to put together a room like this?
Hospitality means a lot. Giving people, you know, something to eat and something to drink, that is like caveman stuff. That's how it's done.
Excellent. And now I'm off to room 722, Mudstomp Records. Mudstomp is a Kansas City-based label, but it's not only labels who are renting out these rooms, even whole states, collectives are renting out the rooms. Whereas there's the Oklahoma room, Colorado room, Wisconsin, Alberta. Walking down this long, skinny hallway, it's sticky, hot, all kinds of people stepping over many legs and making my way around the corner to 722 Mudstomp.
Trains all over the country and wrote these songs, and we got to stop in these amazing cities that we probably wouldn't have gone if we weren't on a train. And one of the cities that we got to stop in was Kansas City. And we got to write a song about Kansas City in motion.
Here it comes.
Woo!
That was KCUR's Hannah Copeland reporting from the Folk Alliance Conference, which sounds like the most fun thing to be called a conference ever. If you missed it this year, there's always next year. Our time is up for this morning's show. You can listen back to the audio files conversation and check out our podcast recommendations at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And you can subscribe to our podcast while you're there, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, local African Americans are digging up the stories of the role their ancestors might have played in the Civil War. How the legacy of slavery makes knowing your own history a complicated process. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.